What's the connection between lions and Arabic language? Well, there are 500 words for lion in Arabic language.
Yeah, 500 words for Arabic has 12 million words. I think it's the top 12 million words. And we have words.
Persian
has 226 million
words.
What? Yes.
Okay.
I'm gonna Google it.
Not Google it. I don't think. No. Wait. No, wait.
You're lying. Come on, Google it.
Let's see.
I don't know, but I think I really like the discussion, you know?
Okay, so apparently Korean wins.
No.
With 1,100,373.
So Arabic has 12 million.
Yes.
No, I read it somewhere. Wait.
Oh, boy.
Mm-hmm.
English.
Then.
Everyone has to go to Patreon to get
Then Japanese. Listen, then Japanese have a.
Two different languages. Billion?
No. Okay, Korean, 1,100,373 words. Then Japanese, exactly 500,000. And then Italiano.
12 million, it says.
260. What is your.
My Google says 12 million. Ericsson,
well, my Google says.
Well, we have different Googles.
Welcome from Athens to all our old and new listeners. Fractured Podcast is dedicated to issues related to people on the move, refugees, asylum seekers, migrants, and you name the issues. Super, super important topics. Every 2 weeks, we bring you a new one, and today will be no different. But before we go into the topic and our guest, here next to me, Rashid Ghali. Rashid is always on the post, me not that much recently, but I'm back.
Hello everyone, thank you for having me back and thanks for Stavros for being here with us. Welcome home again. And yeah, we would like to thank Aperture Company for providing us with these amazing lights. Without them you would never see us. Well, you could still see Sonia, but me you cannot see. You could see my teeth, but that's so thanks Aperture for allowing me to be visible.
Can you be racist towards your own race?
It's not racist, because if you say a black car at night, you cannot see it. You could see a white car. It's the same. It's a color. It's not about racism.
Okay, my husband told me not to speak about this because I'm apparently a very inappropriate person and do not understand cultural inappropriation. So
racism,
whatever Rashid says is appropriate.
Yes, I give you the certification.
Okay, wonderful. Going back to the subject of our podcast. We are going to actually talk about a very, very serious issue today. With us, Stavros Malikoudis, who is a journalist with Solomon. And Stavros, we are meeting today because of the investigation you, Solomon, did together with actually many partners. Lighthouse Reports, Der Spiegel, ARD, newspaper I from Great Britain, Radio Free Europe, and academics from Aston, Liverpool, and Nottingham universities. I hope I didn't, I hope actually managed to name everybody. Your research was on the Balkans. This topic is very close to me because this is how I started my humanitarian journey at the Serbian-Hungarian border back in 2016. And already then we saw many, many horrible things happening at the time. Pushbacks were actually starting only at the time. You guys did this very deep research, not only on deaths at the Balkan route, because we all know for a while that they are happening, but also about the whole industry of this thing not functioning, meaning when people die, how many of them are identified or unidentified, how difficult it is for families to actually find their loved ones, and then What is the procedure? Where are they buried? So this whole thing in the Balkans is very much in the shadow. We actually tried to do some research on the Greek side, and we will speak about this a little bit later. But Balkans is a basically zone where so many things are happening under the radar. So to start our conversation, I would like to ask you, first of all, why are those deaths on the Balkan routes are actually happening? What are the main causes and what are the numbers there?
Sure. First of all, it's really great to be here and thank you very much for the hospitality. I follow the work of Refocus for several years since Lesbos, and it's great to see this space being used so nicely. It's really great. As you said, the Balkans is a passing point for people on the move, and very much of what happens there goes unreported, especially when it comes to people losing their life, being injured, and so. I would say that what we see is that the borders, they become more and more difficult to cross. So you have more drones, more surveillance, more patrols, bigger funding. But that doesn't mean that people stop passing through the Balkans. It means that they choose more difficult and more dangerous routes. So this is why we see this rise in deaths. Causes of death have to do with the weather conditions. I mean, when it's winter, when it's cold, when it's there have been cases of people who died because of being cold, actually. This one issue. Then another issue is people on the move, they might prefer to move during the night, for obvious reasons, like the joke you did before, to not be seen, and avoid walking around in the day. And sometimes they follow the train routes, the train roads,
train tracks,
And there have been cases of people who were too exhausted of walking and walking and walking, who lost their lives out of this accident. And the third reason, which it again connects with the two others mentioned, we recorded several deaths, if I remember correctly, more than 20, in the area of the Drina River, which is this river between Bosnia and Serbia. It's kind of a natural border. It's like how we have Evros with Turkey. So people are trying to cross this, and this is a very dangerous river. I think it was more than 20 deaths that we recorded. So my main understanding of this is this, that it gets more and more difficult to cross the borders, but that doesn't mean that people will stop coming. And then it only means that they will have to go through more difficult conditions.
When 2016, I came to Greece and we were going to cross the border because I was going to Austria. And we slept the night at the border in Thessaloniki, between the Macedonia and Greece. And we slept in this old building, and there's like construction stuff, and we were supposed to go that night. And then we woke up, and then we hear the cops, boom, 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 they open the door, and they take us outside, and it was freezing. We were wearing like thousands of our clothes. And they took us outside, and there were like two cops, two cars, and they put us on the wall, all of us. We were 18. And they were shouting, take your hats out. And I was like, fuck, they're gonna shoot us or what? I was doing this, and they were looking at us. And then another car came, and there is a guy from Bangladesh, he came out with the police, and they told him to look at us. So he started to look at us, and here we don't understand anything, what's happening. He started looking at us one by one, and then he said no, and they let him go. The police left, and they left us there. It was because I thought we're gonna get arrested.
Looking for smugglers?
No, at night I spoke with the smuggler. I told him what's going on, what happened this morning. He told me that boy who came, he was started looking at us. He witnessed a murder between our smuggler, like the original one, and another guy. So he got killed, and he saw the killer. So they brought him to see who killed, and they thought it's us. And then I was like, that was their main key witness, and they let him go. So they didn't see the killer, let him go. And my question is, when there are a lot of these deaths, maybe there are murder cases, does the police in the Balkan treat these some cases as of murder? Do they take DNA? Do they investigate?
Theoretically, every state, when there is a case of someone being, I don't know, shot or stabbed, or there is any assumption of assassination, of killing, they have to follow procedures. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure to what extent they go, like how hard they try to reach that. We know, for example, that in the, and this is not from my reporting, but from what colleagues tell me mostly, that in the north of Serbia, that this has become a very, very, you know, dangerous place. Like, smugglers there, they are now armed with Kalashnikov. Yeah. You know, they are not, you know, the smuggler that you would have in Patras or in Evros. So it's like, it's basically gangs which fight each other for, you know, for dominance, who is going to be the boss of the area. I'm not sure how well these cases are investigated. Like, mm-hmm. there are rumors of people being buried in the forest.
Yeah.
It's a very difficult area, like, for us to go to report on. It's only some local journalists with very good connections with the local authorities, for example. But my understanding is that, in our area, in the Balkans, I wouldn't say that states will put too much effort into trying to find who killed a third country national who they don't really know, you know, maybe what his real name is. I would say that, you know, they have other things to that they prioritize. I wouldn't say that they really invest in this, you know.
Mm-hmm. I assume they also do not have resources to do this, right? When we investigated the situation in Greece when it comes to DNA samples, now the system is working better and better. So at the beginning of the refugee crisis, nothing was really happening. And now this protocol that started in actually Alexandropolis with the people who were crossing the Evros River is being spread. So, for example, Lesvos Island has it now, and they're taking DNA samples from every person whom they find, and they're taking pictures, they're documenting, for example, tattoos, scars, but also things that are very maybe typical just for this one person, like rings and so on. So if people come, later family comes, maybe they can identify it. From your article, I'm assuming that this is not really happening, at least not much in the Balkans. There is definitely not a wide system that would be implemented.
That's also my understanding. Like, when I joined this investigation, I had in mind the coroner, for example, in Alexandroupolis, who is very dedicated to this. And as you said, he takes photos of the tattoos, of the personal items. He's very dedicated to trying to identify people, you know, and having their families know what happened to them. In the Balkans, I would say that it's not a standardized system or practice. So, for example, colleagues who reported in Serbia, they said that some hospitals, they don't have space, practically. They don't have space for the bodies to be kept there for some time. In Alexandroupolis, we know that besides the space, like, the coroner has put some container, fridge container, to accommodate more bodies. My understanding was this, that there is not some standardized procedure. And the saddest thing in this is that we documented cases in which someone might die today, let's say, but until the family is informed several days later, or maybe a week weeks later, the body has been already buried. And the body has been buried as unidentified, and the family has not had the chance to properly, you know, say goodbye to their loved person. I think it's very sad, because we all come from different cultures, but I think in all cultures it's very rooted the idea that you have to properly say goodbye to your loved person, you know, to when they die. This is from the ancient times. Like, it's people used to honor that this human need. There were cases that we documented that this didn't happen, and this was very sad. When you have a parent whose son died and he gets informed weeks later, and then he goes on the spot and all he can see is a grave which doesn't have a name on it. It's like, it's very sad. Yeah.
Like, you cannot really ever go over this, right? There's a reason why we have funerals basically in every culture, because it allows the living ones to cope with the loss, right? Yes. And this, if you really do not see, you really cannot acknowledge the fact that somebody really died, and you live in this in-between world, yes. for a very long time.
Exactly, exactly.
Especially some cultures, for example, the Muslim culture, they like to, even if you die in Europe, if there is possibility, they take you back to a Muslim land. They call it Muslim land. There is this Netflix series. It's about a true story. Two guys from, they are from Belgium, but they have Moroccan descendant origins. So their father died and they couldn't get him there because they didn't have the money. So they pay the guy to send them the soil from Morocco. And he buried they buried him in Belgium with the soil there. And then they started a business. So people started giving them money. And then it became a scandal and they went to jail for it. But it's like Whoa. Amazing how they could make yeah. a lot of money from yeah. this. And I wanted to ask you if there is possibility for these people, like a father, like you said, he comes and he sees his son. Can he take his son and bury him in Syria or Iraq or whatever?
The buried son, you mean?
Yeah, like can he take his dead son and
repatriate the body?
Yes. Yeah.
I think that once the body is buried, there needs some procedure to be followed mm-hmm. for this to happen. I'm not sure, like at that point, mm-hmm. if the body has already been buried, if it's possible. It is possible to repatriate, and it happens also in Greece, in the Balkans. It happens. It's only expensive. I mean, it's you know it can be 3,000 euros, 5,000 euros to bring you know the body back, but it does happen. As I said, it's not always possible. And what we see is that also, and I mean, for example, in Greece, we see that the migrant communities they get together to send the person back home. So, for example, we see from the Pakistani community, from the Bangladeshi, for people who were here and they didn't have family, the community, you know, joins forces and they try to do that. But it's a matter of time, of being able to do it on the right time, because if you find out your, I don't know, a person's body, you know, where it's buried after, I don't know, 1 month, then it's very difficult to have the procedures. You know, to exhume it, a body, I think this needs a court order, for example.
And money, lot.
Yeah. Wow. Like there have been many cases, also from other cases, that relatives asked for a body to be, I don't know the English word, but, you know, brought
repatriate.
To the... Repatriate. Yeah, mm-hmm. you know, to bring in the surface, to... How do you say, like...
To dig out.
Yes,
and, yeah.
but mm-hmm. it needs some, you know, authorities order. It's not... It's not up to the family.
It's a health issue as yes, well, right? Yes. To do it, definitely. When people are looking, those deaths that are happening in the Balkans, basically wherever when you cross the borders, those are, of course, very unexpected deaths, very frequently very brutal deaths. But families usually know after a few days if somebody doesn't text them that they crossed the border, that something bad happened, and they start looking. In your article, you're writing about WhatsApp groups of people who are trying to find their loved ones. How did it start? How do those groups work, actually, yes. to find those people?
There are groups on Facebook and on WhatsApp. To be honest, I don't know how they started. I mean, in what year, who was the person who started them. But it's the kind of groups that people join for exactly for these reasons, to ask for relatives, to ask, you know, like sometimes they post a picture of the person and they ask, have you seen this person? It's basically groups of relatives looking for their people. And this is where you, sometimes these groups have helped document pushback practices. These groups have helped, you know, people understand where their loved one is. And you can basically join them. I mean, they are usually, it's not difficult to join them. And there you can get a very good understanding of all the, you know, the pain in the Balkans because you have so many different cases. And as you said, the parents, because they usually follow the journey of the person, they do get news if something happens. Like one case, one of the guys we wrote about, he was basically he felt sick. He was more weak, you know. So the group wanted to leave him behind because they didn't want to risk being mm-hmm. caught, all of them. And this happens. But the thing is that when families, when they get news of their persons going missing or you know they have lost their whereabouts, sometimes they also have difficulty to travel to the country. For example, if one guy was his brother was missing, and the person we talked with, he was in the UK, and as an asylum seeker in the UK, he couldn't come to the Balkans. You know, he didn't have the right to travel. So then this gets also more complicated because it makes this whole journey to find your person even more difficult.
And they cannot assign someone to go on behalf of their
name. This guy asked a friend to go and look.
But just to look, but if he finds he cannot do anything because he's not a family member.
Cannot sign, And it's always different, you know, like if you look for your person or, you know, if I look for your person, it's... I guess it's a need also for you to take things in your own hands to...
In your article, you mentioned some secret prisons where refugees are being held. And I remember reading this novel about this guy, but he talked about true stories. He's a Moroccan, and he talked about people who going from Morocco to Spain. And he said that they used to put them in this castle. It's a prison, but it's an old castle. And it's under the ground and near the sea. And when there is in the winter, it's flooded. So and they put them in cells under the sea, so they either die or they just like try to survive there. And in the summer, that space, it's really hot, so it's filled with rats, big rats that can even eat you. And I was like, oh my god, they should let them go, I mean, at least, or send them back home. Do you have any info about these secret prisons in the Balkan?
I think that they came to existence because the pushbacks also changed. So for example, in 2016 that you mentioned, people were more, let's say, allowed to cross. It was easier to cross. But also when pushbacks happened, it was more an issue of you cross the borders, and after some, you know, 100 meters, some 1,000 meters, like not reaching to Thessaloniki, for example, you know, they would catch you in the area and they would push you back. Now what we see in the past years is that, and we call them kidnappings. I mean, it's a very hard word, but it's kidnappings. Because you have people who are either in Thessaloniki, which is, I think, 400 kilometers from the border. And they are being, you know, caught by some, you know, people, put in some van, brought to the next place, And I think that this system, you know, more systematic pushbacks with different levels, they have created the need for the secret sites, because they need to catch, kidnap, you know, in my words, some people. They bring them to the site until they bring more, and then from there another, you know, other border guards, they bring them to the next site. So it's, I think they have to do with the more systematic level of pushbacks. Lighthouse Reports has documented such sites in Bulgaria, where people were held, and they have also photos of it. The New York Times, they have done a story about a secret site in Evros, in our border area of Turkey. And there are more, I mean, but it's always difficult to, you know, usually there are abandoned warehouses. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's, you don't really go there. It's,
We actually did a podcast episode on this topic, meaning the Bulgarian-Turkish border, and we actually had Maria Chereseva with us, who did this research with you as well. So whoever wants to learn more about this, it's episode 11 of season 2. It's called EU's Forgotten Border, and we're speaking about those topics there and Maria's research. And at some point, she's even picturing this scenario in this prison that was basically made out of dog's cage in a police station. So it was a courtyard of a police station becomes like a place to hold refugees and asylum seekers who are trying to cross the border. And a cover for our audiogram that we put on our social media is actually a picture that Maria shared with us. And if you find it, I really actually added to the notes of this podcast, because this picture was, you know, like you lose any faith in humanity when you see that people could be captured in something like this. Anyways, season 2, episode 11, if somebody is interested in this topic and wants to brief themselves more. Stavros, it is time for a very short break for us. And during this break, we have something interesting for our listeners, namely a trailer of a movie called Even After Death. This movie has been made by Refocus Media Labs Collective back in 2019 and 2020, when we investigated the situation of deaths In Greece predominantly. So it's the situation in the Aegean Sea, but also at the border between Turkey and Greece in the north. We encourage everybody to watch it, but also if you are interested in organizing a screening of this movie, raise more awareness of the situation, we encourage you to contact us. There are links to our contacts in the notes, so get in touch. And now a trailer of Even After Death.
I think everybody saw the first time that the port police guards have been bringing out bodies. Yes, I remember, but I don't want to remember. And I presume that there are many people that they died and nobody knows they died.
And actually last night I had two calls from Iran, and I had the SMS from a mom that she is looking, an Iranian mom, that she is looking for her daughter, which is 18 years old, and she's looking, it is 2 years that she is looking for her daughter.
We believe that when the body is died, the spirit of Ruh is alive.
خب شوهر مد من و می فکر باش اگه چرا که شوهرم همی جنازه شانم یک تسلیم که شدیم دیگه چشمای شوهرم باز خیلی یعنی در وضعیت بد جان داده بود به حد فکر نارام بود جان داده به حد
And their last right, which is to be respected as a dead body, that it is not happening, it is so painful. It is really painful. And then thinking that when one person is dying here, it doesn't mean that it's finished. It means that the families are back. If you cannot find the relatives, so always you are suffering.
If you don't know that this is a cemetery, a mass grave actually, I would say, then nobody would know that this is actually a location where about 400 migrants are buried.
The most important for me is respect. Respect from the body, from the dead man, and respect from the relatives who wait some news from someone. I give some answers. It's not a good answer. It's a bad answer. But from the relatives, it's answer.
Welcome back after the break. We are talking to a journalist of Salomon, Stavros Malihoudis. Stavros, one more time, thank you very much for being with us and sharing your findings from your research on the Balkans. In your article, you quote at some point families of those who died at those borders who were searching for their loved ones. And they are saying money is requested at every step of the process. So they're saying, they're using the word, we have a similar one in Polish, like you have to oil or grease to get some information, to do anything. They're talking about speaking to morgues to get any information if anybody died and so on. How big is this situation? How big is corruption, I guess, I'm guessing, in this specific area in the Balkans?
First of all, we have the same word also, oil. And once I was told that it comes from the times when they would literally bring oil, to
really?
Someone to, yep. to help them with what they needed, like a public servant. So this was the case in specific areas, specifically in Burgas, in the hospital there. My colleagues reported on this. It was not my own reporting, but they had different testimonies of families which, when they were trying to, to look at the bodies to identify their person, if it was among them, they were asked for money, which is it's not, you know, like this is not the procedure, of course, the standard procedure. They were asked for 300 euros at some cases. And in one case, the person who was looking for their for his loved one, when he asked some border guards to look at some pictures of people who were found, the border guards replied something like, we don't have time for this, you know, we're too busy. And then they asked for 25 euros per photo shown to them. This, at least in Burgas, this seemed to be quite widespread. I mean, people knew about it. Sources on the field confirmed it, as you said. Especially there, it happened. For example, we didn't see that in Bosnia, for example, mm-hmm. During our reporting. We didn't have such cases. When we asked the management of the hospital in Burgas, they said that they are not aware of any, you know, case like this. They have not received any single complaint about it. But this is, again, it's very sad because we understand that, you know, someone is at a very difficult moment when they are searching for their persons. So, you know, you actually take advantage of a person in a very vulnerable position, and this person, of course, will find the money to give it to you because, you know, he or she needs to do it. But this was a case especially in Burgas. Like, and thankfully, for example, in Greece, we don't hear such testimonies. In Bosnia, we didn't hear such testimony. It seemed to be there. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, documented at least.
Mm-hmm. We spoke some time ago of somebody who helped a person who died at the border with Macedonia, so Greece, Macedonia. And the situation was that money was also requested in the morgue to see the body, but probably because some Westerners were present and they said, there's no problem paying you, you're just gonna come with a journalist who follows us every step of the way, so would you mind repeating it, how much it costs to see a body in front of the journalist? And of course they said, no, it's just, you know, like a tip for yes. for a person, it's yes. nothing is requested, so we didn't have to pay. But it is like really happening everywhere, and it's extremely sad because it's not, to be clear, it's not a service you're paying for to prepare a body or something. It is just to see or even get information, right, to that something actually happened.
I remember the the article you sent about the corruption index perception, mm-hmm. and Greece is 47 ranks, and Bulgaria 67.
Yeah.
Ranks, Bosnia 108, Serbia 104, Albania 98, Macedonia 76. Well, it sounds like I'm being racist, but let me just be honest that I grew up in Algeria 104. Like, if you are lost there is no news. You cannot even know about it. So just to be clear, it's really difficult. And I want to ask that...
basically, what they say is, for this, it's sometimes, you know, the people in the hospitals, they are overworked. Like, as you said, you know, the hospital is understaffed. They work a lot, they get tired. And then they are like, you know, they might ask for this because... I don't know. But again, you know, it's part of the job. I mean,
they see it as an extra.
Yes, yes. And this, we know that this happens in many different levels of life. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, even when you go to, I don't know, mm-hmm. to the tax office, you know, you can do what you need in 10 days, or you can, you know, put the oil that we said
Bring before and
do it in 2 days. Yeah.
So Europe spends a lot of money on cameras, drones, wires to protect their borders. And are they spending any money to fight those local mafias? They are there, they are like terrorizing the refugees, because I heard many stories. I actually witnessed a couple were talking to the police in the border saying that there is a mafia there, Pakistani mafia or whatever they said, and they are taking our money and we cannot cross, and the police did nothing. And they were staying there in the jungle and robbing people.
Which area did you...
Macedonia, yeah.
Yes, for sure they invest a lot in mm-hmm. all these systems, all the surveillance, the, you know, barbed wire, like bigger and bigger lands are getting, you mm-hmm. know, like fences. I wouldn't say that they invest a lot in this combat. I mean, the case that we said before, in the north of Serbia, this is a great example because it's a very, very dangerous place. We were told that, for example, as you probably know, like in some cases you have to pay the smugglers just to be allowed to try the game, like just to, you know, it's like protection, like how here maybe, you know, some shops they pay protection just to be allowed to be open to function. You have to pay just to try. For example, this is the case in Patras, in the port of Patras, with people who try to go to Italy irregularly through the ferries. They have to pay the smugglers just to be allowed to try, you know, like, and we were told that, you know, from friends who tried it. Serbia is, for me, you know, according to the testimonies and what colleagues say, it seems to be like the most dangerous place at the moment. And you have, we said, like gangs with Kalashnikov. It's like, you know, if we know about it, and if we know about it for the past 2 years, like, I guess the authorities also know about it, right? It's, you know, we are some people in a room and we discuss about it. They have intelligence about it. They know how they work. But there it seems more and more dangerous. Like, we were told that people, if they don't pay, they don't pay the smugglers, sometimes they get, like a knife like this, you know, which will serve as warning to the next persons that, you know, you cannot do it, you have to pay. You know, like a warning, like...
It's a cut on the forehead, like a symbol that this came from that.
Yes, like, so that other people will see that and they will pay the smugglers. So, it you know, it's a very unregulated area, it's a very unsafe area for people on the move, especially, because people on the move, as the borders, they become more and more difficult to cross, the people on the move, they become more dependent on the smugglers. And when the smugglers, they are armed with Kalashnikovs and they are mafias and they are doing all this kind of stuff, you know, people on the move, they are really exposed. And I wouldn't say, like, for Serbia, the situation is like that for the past 3 years, and it's getting worse. We are now hearing that this expands more, like, to other countries. So I wouldn't say that they're investing in combating. Or if they do, we don't see the results yet. I don't know.
The very sad situation here is that, as you're saying, the situation in the Balkans is getting more and more dangerous, and it's more and more underreported. I mean, even Greece is underreported right now, right? But this Balkan route is happening. There are so many people still crossing it, and there's neither anything good happening in the policy department, so we don't see really much changes. I mean, the new EU pact on migration is a completely separate topic we can speak about on a different occasion. But there are no solutions to these situations. There are no safe passages. There are no incentives to keep people, for example, in Greece. And at the same time, your report and the fact actually that you did it in this collaboration with so many other partners is something very unusual, meaning that it was spread to many news stations and so on. But we don't have it. That there's almost every week something really tragic is happening in the Balkans. And of course, there are so many extra topics that can be covered, but we don't see it. Like, Balkans is almost a no land when it comes to media now.
It is. I'm not sure if there are media that can support, you know, financially this kind of work. For example, this was a project by Lighthouse Reports, which has this unique ability to really invest in investigations and, you know, actually support journalists for months to work on this. This is not the case in Greece, you know, like, this is not the case in most media. And I think that one point is that also, you know, reporting in the Balkans is kind of, there is a kind of a hostile environment for journalists, for activists, for researchers. So when there is more pressure, you know, some people will leave, some people will go on a different beat, some people who were based somewhere, they will move. In Greece, we have this case with Lesbos, for example, with the islands. It's like, it's nothing how it used to be, I don't know, 4 years ago. And the sad thing with this, of course, is that when the watchdogs, they are away, you know, then bad things can happen easier. Like, if we compare now, like, the level of reporting that was available in the Balkans, you know, like 3 years ago, or in Greece, I don't know, 3 years ago, and now we have much worse things happening now, but there's nobody there to, you know, to document them, to witness them. And I don't think this is by luck, you know, I think this is a systematic effort to actually take the, you know, take the observers away. I wouldn't say it's, you know, it happened by luck.
Yeah. you, or I think maybe Lighthouse Reports covers this topic when it comes to methodology, how you were trying to get just the numbers from morgues, from hospitals, and you got very few to talk to you or give you any information.
This was, it's again a thing of the Balkans, I guess, and I include Greece in this. So basically we asked for data. For me, one very, very important issue is that, for example, in Greece, you have the Red Cross, and in many other countries, which they have a mandate to work on such cases. In the Balkans, we didn't see that. There is presence of the Red Cross, but it didn't have the same mandate. Like to contact the families, to do the identification processes. They didn't. I mean, it was even more difficult to have this kind of numbers. And our investigation is focused in six morgues across a route that we identified as, you know, a common route for people on the move. So it was not an extensive documentation of, you know, all the numbers in the Balkans, because this, I think, it would be, you know, like quite, you know, impossible, you know. Like there are different kind of recordings, different countries. One authority answers, the other authority doesn't answer. This is always the issue with such cases, especially in unidentified deaths, for example.
We spoke about the death, so I want to ask about the missing people. Is there any efforts by the local authorities when someone calls, like, hey, I talked to my brother and he was in Serbia at that place at that time? Does anyone go and look for any NGO or Red Cross? No. Do they let someone search?
NGOs, they work on the field. For example, in Serbia, there is Click Active, who they also go to the border areas. They are very. I met with them, and they are, you know, they are very dedicated. Again, I wouldn't say that authorities, you know, they will go out of their way to search for someone, you know, named Abdul, for example. Mm. You know, like, very frankly, like, I don't think that this will be their concern. Yes, as you said, like, they don't have unlimited resources, but more than that, I think it's not a priority. You know, it's like, I think now there's an understanding in the Balkans that people cross, some people go missing. Mm-hmm. You know, that's life. Like, you know, like, this kind of perception is like, and you can see that also on the way in the way that local media report on the people who die or go missing or are get injured. It's, you know, it's very, they are used to it. You see it, you know, like, people die, there is an accident, and it's a small report. It's like, you know, this happened. It's like yesterday it rained. It's this kind of news, because people are, you know, are used to that. It's like, it's they see that for decades. It's without saying that it's, you know, that's nice, but I just say that it's more cynical, the approach.
In your article, you're presenting several protagonists, people who were searching for their loved ones. And this one person named Hussam, he's living already in Denmark, and he was looking for his son, who turned out to be dead. And as the authorities told him, he died of hunger and cold. Young person. So his father lives in Denmark. And I was wondering if you think that part of this problem here, part of the solution to this problem, could be a reform of a system of reuniting families. I'm asking about this because, in my view, this actually could solve many issues related to the humanitarian crisis in the south of Europe, because so many people have relatives in Western Europe who could already support them. And here, in my view, this young people who was trying to join his father in Denmark maybe wouldn't have to die if he was allowed to join his father legally.
I totally agree. Ideally, you know, he would be able to get on a plane and, like, in next month I'm going to visit my brother in Denmark, for example. He lives in Denmark. And for me, it's a plane, you know, like, you buy a ticket and you get on a plane. There's not much, you know, I don't really see why, you know, he shouldn't be able to do that. And for me, it's just, like, we call it the game, like, this whole issue of crossing the borders, but it's not fun, you know. It's like, when you, and it doesn't make sense. If you, you know, if you leave the legal aspect aside, it doesn't make sense that he had to travel through all these countries to go to Denmark, and then he might, like, his right to live there might be recognized, might be accepted. But first, it's like you have to go through all these, you know, dangers, all these difficulties, get exposed to smugglers, get exposed to the weather. I don't think that if you, you know, if you have a discussion with somebody and you explain that to him or her, it makes sense. It's like, and it's again, you know, also this value of family, like the family is there. Like the fact that someone gets over 18, he doesn't count as a minor anymore. It's, you know, this leaves him totally exposed. It's like you have to find your own way, cross all these countries, get through all these difficulties, and then you will be accepted, probably, in Denmark. Like, it doesn't make sense. I don't know. I mean, it's, my analysis is not very, you know, legal or very, you know, grounded in international law and all these regulations, but it's, but from the human aspect, it doesn't make sense how you say to someone that you have to cross all these countries, all these borders, and then you can stay in Denmark. It's like it's.
Right now, you have to be a minor under 18, and your parent is already somewhere farther, or it's a spouse reunification. But it's a big problem because you need to have really legal documents of your marriage, right? And religious marriages do not count usually. So there are so many issues with that. And for me, the really thing that I cannot understand is that people, lawmakers, they do not see the value of family reunification. You could get so many additional benefits from this. And I'm not only talking about the human side, but also the economic benefits. When people are already going to somebody who can at least partly cover their needs, right? Yes, so we do not have housing issues and a lot of other support systems. So as a really big big fan of this solution, I think we should actually make one episode on that, what can be possible and how this can be reformed.
And there are cases where someone is in Greece, let's say, the family moves to Europe, but because in the meantime he has turned 18, he has now a different case. So, for example, we had cases in Patras of a guy who was trying to go to Italy. His family was in Greece before, but it got he got 18, so he got like a different case. Like, you are on your own now, you know, you are an adult, like I'm an adult. But then, you know, like, this doesn't stop the person of having a family and wanting to be with the family. And if the family went to Germany, then he has to find his own way to get there. It's like, yeah, I don't know. It's
My last question. I read in on IOM website some data. So they said as of 2024, there are 117 people dead or missing.
Already.
1 month.
Already. Yes.
Already. So my question is there any, are there any solutions from Europe? What Europe should do to stop this?
I'm a very pessimistic person, but I think that in 10 years from now, we will be here and we'll be talking about the same things. Although it's really nice here, so it's you know, it's a good environment. But I don't think, I mean, because what we see as a solution is that we are describing this hostile environment, but we see that it's becoming more hostile because they, you know, they make the borders harder to cross. They want to make agreements with non-EU countries to have the people there, like
Albania.
Yeah. So I think we, you know, it's getting worse. It doesn't get better. And what we talked about, these legal ways, to, like pathways to get to the EU, I don't see it. I mean, we had, for, you know, like, don't go too far. Like when Kabul fell to the Taliban and, you know, people were, of course, you know, escaping Afghanistan. We had this crazy case that the Greece and other countries, their main concern was how are we going to stop these people, because now they might try to come to Greece, so we need to stop them.
Oh.
You know, like the focus was not in the humanitarian side at all, and you had this crazy, in my view, situation where EU countries were flying planes to bring back some people, like a very, very, very small percentage, and at the same time making the borders more difficult for the majority of the people not to come. It's like, yes.
Where's the logic in that,
yeah,
right?
There's no logic. Like, mm-hmm. you bring a plane with, I don't know, officials, but at the same time you stop people like you and me from coming, like normal people.
And it's all about your passport and when, where you were born. When you were saying you will be travel safely to Denmark with just a flight, no visa, probably your ID only. And there are people who go through those absolutely terrifying routes just to get to some kind of a safety.
Yes.
I mean, it's obvious which side are we on here. But to end, you put in your article this phrase that very much resonates with us, because this is a little bit towards the title of our movie. You say that people who died at the borders, at those borders, because of those harshnesses, because of the problems with identification, funerals, and so on, they live even after death because of this whole terrible situation. And I think for their relatives, sometimes it is like death while they're still living, because they still cannot get the answers about their loved ones and where they're buried, if this is actually them in this funeral or in this graveyard. So, Stavros, thank you very much for joining us today. Thank you to our listeners and to our viewers. And one more time, if you missed our break in the middle, I would like to inform you that it is possible to organize a screening of our movie called Even After Death that touches upon those deaths at seas and on the land border between Greece and Turkey. This serves as a tool of fundraising, but also as a tool to raise awareness. So if you're interested, get in touch. Thank you very much to our whole Refocus family who's contributing to this episode and the whole podcast. And we will be with you in 2 weeks' time.
See you. Bye.
You know that he does stand-ups?
Mm? Mm-hmm.
Yes. In Greek, so not only.
My first time in Greek, yeah.
When?
Yeah.
Did you do already or are you going to?
No, I did it in Greek, yeah. It was an open mic. So, but I could not. It was so difficult. I was so anxious. I was reading
English?
From my phone, but they were laughing. So it's just my best joke I did them in.
That's nice.
Yeah. I just want
to... I like the one when you were talking about Greek language and how you're struggling with Greek language and how Erdogan is like applauding you for that.
Yeah, that's it was in my mind.
Everything can be political.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, I'm trying to bring some trauma there to say, okay.
Trauma to stand up.
Yeah, I mean, that's therapy for me. Yeah, what can you do?
That's interesting and that's really awesome.
Yeah, of course, yeah. Yep.
How do people react to your jokes about trauma?
They come and they try to give me some comedians, they try to give me some tips, and they're like, can I give you a tip about this? Because it's traumatized. I'm like, I was talking about it, it's okay, shoot, tell me, it's okay. And they say, you can make it better here, and they're afraid. They are like, traumatize me more. I'm like, it happened to me, I mean, it's okay, just...
Yeah, I thought that day some people will come and just like, you know, we can get you help, I know some psychologists or stuff like this.
No, they don't do it with me.
No, so everybody wants to make fun of trauma.
I don't know. If you're a comedian, do it. I don't know. Yeah.
No, I think whatever helps, right?
Yeah.